What is school sucks? What do you do? I say we try to teach the skills that school does not.
Yeah.
Right. We're hitting on so many of those. Organization, coordination, negotiation, communication, problem solving, critical thinking. Very little of that is taught in school. I would say at any level. I'm thinking like you guys must have approaches that you take frequently. Let's just pick negotiation. I'm fascinated by you just from watching you and hanging out with you over the last month and a half, how serene you are all the time.
I'm a pretty calm, happy guy.
You are, despite juggling and trying to coordinate a tremendous number of disparate things. Mm. Can you guys each talk about, you know, the negotiation strategies? Has something emerged as like a set of rules emerged for you in these situations, or are there no
rules? I've never really thought about this. This is a really awesome
question. You got it all figured out, so I'm wanting to know how you guys do it.
Most of the time when there's conflicts like this, I don't think people's natural inclination is to meet the conflict. Most people appeal to an adult.
Yeah.
This is what I do for a living. I am the adult of a movie set in a lot of ways, which is actually, you guys both know me in my personal life, is terrifying. Really ironic and terrifying.
But honestly, it's kind of funny you said adult, because that's actually a thing that's said within the film industry all the time.
Where
it's
like,
the adults are here. Or we need to ask
an adult. We need an adult on set. I've said it all the time. I've said it in response to get the producers to set. Because I will call Bowers on a walkie-talkie, and I'll be like, Bowers, I need an adult in here.
That's not a joke.
That means get me a producer.
Yeah.
Because this situation that we just described, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't reconcile this. We're actually at a point that maybe it can't be reconciled. I need a producer to come down here and make a decision, put a stamp on it, and be the one that's responsible for this thing.
Let me ask you this, okay? A theme that we've explored, and there's other people doing it too, like Jonathan Haidt, right?
Mm-hmm. And who I am just a huge fan of his work.
But we've talked about
valuable.
This, yes, a lot on the show, is that, you know, well, we're trying to analyze some of the behavioral and emotional problems evidenced by the generation of people going through college right now, mm-hmm. right? Millennials. There's many of these people mm-hmm. on a film set. But one of the things in needing an adult, we're all probably old enough to remember like playing alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people in that age group are not, you know, they've never been left
to
you know, resolve their own problems, the social problem. There's always an adult hovering around,
yes.
right? Have you noticed this request for an adult is age group dependent in any way?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
No.
That's interesting. I like that.
People ask me, again, when you think about what you know about me and my personal life.
Sure.
You think this is absurd. Grown men and women who are much older than I am even will ask me permission to use the bathroom. I've had 50 and 60 and 70 and 80 year olds raise a hand on set and ask me to go to the bathroom. I've had Academy Award winners ask me if I can use a toilet.
The School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Gosh, everybody, what a day. It's September 13th, and this is a big show. I'm very excited to welcome two filmmakers and School Sucks listeners, Dutch and Scott. I met these guys in New Orleans back in May. They were working together on a project down there,
And Dutch actually pitched, see how I'm learning the vocab here? The idea of doing a show about the factory process of making films. There's this misconception. It's not a misconception. There's this kind of almost like a contradiction. Film is this incredibly creative medium, but the actual process of making a film very much follows an industrial model, a factory model. And in our preliminary discussion about this, that's gone on for months, we talked about a lot of interesting tie-ins with the lessons of school. And we agreed that we would have a fascinating production, especially for an audience, from what I know about you, that is hungry for more shows about the entertainment industry, especially film and film analysis. And we do all of that in this marathon conversation that you're going to be hearing either in two or three parts. I'm still editing. I'm not sure, but that's my job. I'll figure that out. So Dutch and Scott have very different origin stories, too. Scott actually went to film school, while Dutch worked his way up from pretty much the very bottom of a film set. About 10 years ago, they started working together. They're a really wonderful team. I think that will be evident in the conversation that's about to play out. But in addition to their stories, they also talk about this industrial model of filmmaking. We asked the difficult question, could something happening on such a massive scale work in any other way? That's a challenging question. We'll tangent into some analysis of some of our favorite films, and we'll actually do an anatomy of film production as well, like what happens on the set when a film is being made. Lots of stuff I didn't know, and I'm thinking the same is going to be true for many of you, because I'm pretty into this stuff, and I learned a lot from this conversation. If you like what you hear in today's conversation or in the other conversations in this series or even other shows that are coming in the very near future, please consider supporting School Sucks Project. I feel like I say this all the time, but when I do say it, new people support the show. And I have a feeling that today one of those new people is going to be you. Go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV to see all of the support options, including the AV Club, which gets you access to hundreds of hours of additional content going all the way back to 2010. The easiest and fastest way to get access to all the bonus content we've done since 2016, however, is Patreon. That is patreon.com/schoolsucks. We also have shopping options. Like, you just want to shop. You just want to buy the things you need. You can do that through Amazon. We have crypto options. Remember crypto? Go ahead and send me your Ethereum. I'll ride it all the way down to zero for you. So help us out if you can. It's great to be back to work. This is my first time since last October that I've recorded with my mixer and all my little compressors and my Shure SM7B microphone at my big desk. Even though we were on mobile equipment in the conversation you're about to hear, these guys were the first guest in the new studio, the Studio of Champions. Now 87% complete. Stay tuned for updates as we finish off that last 13%. So that's it. Let's get right into this because this is a long one. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again very soon.
All right. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks.
Me
for
too.
This.
Yeah,
this
thank
is awesome.
You.
What if that was the first thing that was on the show?
Are you recording? Did you get that? I'm not going to do it again.
I'm recording. We'll go around the table and introduce ourselves. Sounds and then good. I'm going to swing back to you guys for like a brief autobiography.
Okay? Oh, okay.
So my name is Brett Vinod. I'm the host of School Sucks. How about you, sir?
Thomas D.H. Guy, but I go by Dutch.
Dutch.
Because of that difficult last name.
And my name is Scott Bowers.
Awesome.
So easy to pronounce.
This is, in 2018, this is the show that I am most excited about.
No, that can't be
so
possible.
Far.
That can't
yes,
be true.
It is absolutely true in the 9 months of this year. When we first talked about this, the three of us met in New Orleans, right?
Yes.
At Renegade University and School Sucks Project Present, A Weekend with Thaddeus Russell.
Mm-hmm.
You guys were working on a project together down there.
Yep.
A film,
mm-hmm.
which we're going to get into. Not into that film, but into what you do. And you came to the event. I'd say we hit it off.
Oh, yeah. I think so.
You said you might have a project coming up in Pittsburgh at that point. We would not only become pals,
yep.
but we would do this show.
I don't even think even that was even as much of a consideration at that point. I think we just hit it off and we became pals. And
mm-hmm.
you hadn't even decided where you were going to live.
That's right.
You were just like, yeah, I'm looking for a place to live and I'm driving across the country and I'm doing this whole thing.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's cool. Let's just be friends anyway. And wherever you land, because you said, you know, we had discussed maybe one of these days I would come on the show.
Yeah.
And we'd do exactly what we were doing. But I was like, yeah, man. You were like, oh, maybe I'll come to New York. And I said, you could do that. Or I travel a lot. Maybe I'll be in the same town as you. Maybe I'll come to see you wherever you move. And then it just, this is actually a really serendipitous setting, I'd think.
Absolutely. We are christening almost a new studio. It's almost. Still kind of like, I'd say this is like 80% done.
If honestly, this is the first time I've done one of these.
Yeah.
So this feels...
It feels 100%
done. 100% done.
Looks right. Good.
So none of the fancy audio equipment is hooked up yet. So right. We're on mobile equipment, which is the only equipment that at this point I think I remember how to use because it's what fancy. I've been using since last October.
Yeah.
But all of this stuff needs to be hooked up, and then we're done. And then we have to figure out lighting, which you guys could probably help with
a little bit.
A little bit. Yeah.
This overhead light is the first thing that's going to go.
It is certainly going to go. It's terrible. Hey, do you ever do like set design? Like in your long careers, did you ever have to do?
I started in the art department.
Okay. So you could probably find studs in a wall.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I can do that because of home renovations, though.
Oh, perfect.
Just finding studs in the wall sucks.
We'll get this TV up. We'll
we
get the lighting
fixed. We should
do
a whole show on studs in the wall sucking.
And then you also get to learn a little bit about the behind the scenes of audio for your future podcasting needs.
Yes.
We can learn together.
I'm so about learning.
And
another reason I'm here.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Isn't this, and Scott, you just arrived. You're not, Dutch is here working on a film. We can't say anything about that. We can't say anything about the film that you guys were working on together in New Orleans, but we can talk a little bit about what you guys do together. First of all,
certainly.
You're in Pittsburgh just visiting because you guys write together?
Correct.
And work together, yeah.
And work together.
We've worked together since...
Probably
2000 and I want to say eight. Yeah, 2008 we met each other.
Right.
Yeah.
I hated him immediately.
Why is that?
No. We became...
Friends?
I don't know if we became immediate friends, but there was definitely a mutual level of respect, I think.
Yeah.
I won't speak for you. Based on the look on his eye right now. But we got along, we became friends, and then we wound up doing, as PAs, production assistants, the lowest rung on the making a movie ladder.
Sure.
I think we did 12 shows, projects together.
Yeah.
So like TV like and that. Movies?
TV and movies, yeah.
Mostly movies.
Mostly movies we worked on together, but then, you know, there's a few instances of like, you know, Scott was on a TV show and I'd come work for him for a day or two or did a pilot of a TV show and then me and Scott both worked on it, but it was like a really short thing or even sometimes things that didn't get picked up, I'm sure we did something stupid, something terrible, yeah.
What was your professional relationship on the project you were doing in New Orleans? Because that's most recent, and that kind of like sets where we are now.
So I'm a first assistant director, and Scott is a second assistant director, a key second assistant director, as they call it, because there's more than one second assistant director on a movie set.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing. I don't know why it works like that, but it does. So me and Scott are basically a 1-2 combo of our department.
Right.
We're the head of our department, which is the assistant director department.
So we're going to get into like how a film production works today.
Oh,
and I
yes.
think a good way to start is we'll start with Scott and then we'll go to you, Dutch. These jobs, this is pretty common that this is your role. I mean,
I dabble in other things.
You dabble in other things.
I've directed second units before and I've produced things before, but my main bread and butter, my means of making all of my bread is by being a first assistant director, yeah.
Okay. And you second?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I think some vocabulary that's useful, just so we don't speed too far ahead of this. Films, especially things like action films, always have a first and a second unit. And my understanding is the first unit is working with the principal cast, and the second unit is more like action scenes, stunts, long, like, distance stuff.
Correct.
So, like... For people who know about movies but not the making of movies, a film like Apocalypse Now would have had an enormous second unit production.
Depends.
I don't know.
It'll depend really, here's the thing that I think everything that you've said is correct.
Okay.
As a general thing. And this is something that we'll get into is like, what is the general thing and how people sometimes deviate from that thing. And so like a filmmaker like Francis Ford Coppola may have done things a little differently than say a film like a studio Marvel property or DC property, which would basically all of this comes out of efficiency's sake. So the first unit is shooting like the most valuable kind of resources that are the hardest to get back. So Robert Downey Jr. is only going to give you so much time.
Right.
So anything that can kind of be shot that's, you know, the Iron Man mask or a shot of the sky as Iron Man is supposed to be flying across it, right? That
yeah.
doesn't actually involve anything but a shot of the sky and computer effects is in like the value judgments of how you spend your time and money as a production. You would say, okay, well, we're going to have kind of a B squad go out to shoot the sky at the same time that we're shooting Robert Downey Jr. on a stage.
Yeah, I did that like specifically those things like on a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
Where like you go out there and you shoot, you know, the skyline of New York and then Spider-Man like flies across,
mm-hmm.
things like that, like tops of buildings where you like pounces and lands.
Where there's no real human being actually yeah. flying or swinging. So you're just shooting literally a shot of like the tops of buildings that you'll one day intend to put a spaceship into or a mm-hmm. Spider-Man or a Superman or some crazy inexplicable reason an Aquaman. I don't know.
So in certain types of films, like especially these superhero movies,
yep.
People think about first and second unit being like, okay, the actors do all their stuff. And then after that, we go and we get all these shots. I mean, I think that's like the most basic way you would think about it. But in many of the movies that we've seen, especially like the explosion of superhero movies, like mm-hmm. post 9/11, I think is really like, but I don't remember this genre being, certainly not as powerful or successful before that. I mean, it certainly existed, but nothing like a scope.
The Tim Burton Batmans.
They're different, right?
As a franchise entity. But yes, it is different. It's not like nobody was signing Michael Keaton to a 7-picture deal.
Exactly.
To play Batman 7 times and then a spin-off Robin movie and then an appearance in a spin-off Catwoman movie and that.
Right. Yeah, we've never seen anything like what we've seen with Marvel.
Yeah.
And the thing about first and second unit is like these things are actually layered over each other.
Yes.
I wouldn't have thought about that. You know, I mean, like when I was trying to understand how the filmmaking process works, and I use this Apocalypse Now example, right?
Mm.
Apocalypse Now is famously a clusterfuck, right?
Yeah.
So
special.
It's very special as far as the film production is concerned.
Yeah.
And anything that DC or Marvel is doing, I would guess, is way more corporate, way more regimented. And you also have like 30 years of learning from mistakes like Apocalypse
yeah.
Now.
Yes.
To prevent things like that,
100%.
I would think. Yeah.
Yeah, which is something that you can't just like brush under the rug really quickly, right? Like, you know, Heaven's Gate destroying United Artists, right? Like that production being as big of a clusterfuck that it is, that it literally destroyed a studio that was like an institution
yeah.
for
yeah.
decades. Is like nothing that you can easily forget about in the context of like, why are the movies that are being made? Like, you know, people say something as simple or an innocuous of a question as like, why is there nothing with superhero movies out? Like,
mm-hmm.
there's a long lineage of history that kind of like goes into that answer. That's like really, really complicated. But like, yeah, movies like the third Godfather, the first Godfather, even like, Heaven's Gate. Like any kind of movie, Waterworld, you know, like things that were like big flops
yeah.
have really kind of defined what the risk is in the business. And in that way, it affects like what is risk adverse as well, which is the thing that a studio is going to be the most drawn to because they don't want to, they're going to spend $200 million. They don't want to lose any of it.
Indeed. So what would each of you say is like something that studios don't want to deal with right now? If something comes to mind versus like, and then you could each take like a highly desirable, based on what you're finding.
What they don't want to do?
Yeah. What they want to avoid.
I'm not really sure.
I mean,
lose money.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's the thing that I think that there's, here's the thing that's kind of weird that I always kind of hear or get into is like Hollywood having some kind of like political agenda and this like axe to grind kind of thing and willing to like lose millions of dollars and like spreading some kind of, it's just there are certain parts of that conversation to me that are kind of asinine
mm-hmm.
because it's like when you're talking about Disney, Sony, Warner Brothers that are like these massive corporate entities with boards of directors and public shareholders, right? It's like they're always operating the same as any other company, which is trying to make as much money as humanly possible for the company and the shareholders to the point where they have like, and probably in some way think of it as a obligation to do so.
Right. Well, then you have the people. So you're saying this like idea of pushing a narrative.
You're trying to tap into whatever the movement seems to be.
You're riding a bull.
Yeah. More like when than... you see like the, yeah, what was it? Like the, was it like Kylie Jenner, like, Pepsi ad?
I vaguely remember this.
But it's just like, you know, it's like a, it's trying to tap into like this like kind of thing of like, you know, mass protest being like trying to like make that an in vogue thing. And it's like, I think it's Kylie Jenner. She like walks up to like these like, you know, riot gear police
with Pepsi guys,
yeah, and gives them a Pepsi.
That sucked. It's like, yeah, you know, that was bad.
Like, chill out. It's all cool. We're just trying to make peace out here in the streets.
So people get super conspiratorial about this, too, because it's not so. Just pushing, like, left-wing politics. It is... Have you guys ever heard of the Vigilant Christian?
No.
Oh, man. This is a YouTube channel you might want to check.
Oh, boy.
So the messages of Satan, mm-hmm. of debauchery, of... What's the word? Degradation.
Yeah.
You know, of the culture. Mm-hmm. That Hollywood pushes, and they would say, even people who would just say it comes down to like pushing a left-wing political agenda, mm-hmm. they would say this happens. Of course, there's a board of directors and there's studio heads that only care about making money,
yeah.
right? But then in the writer's room.
Yes, the writer's
room. All the agenda-driven people. Now, you can, or all the Satanists or mm-hmm. all the people who are trying to push, that's where they are.
Yeah.
You know? So there's a whole YouTube genre.
Oh,
about trying to not just, decoding the messages in yeah. movies is very interesting. I actually have a friend, Jay Dyer, who wrote a book. Mm. Obviously, we understand, like, you know, film semiotics is a thing. People use symbols in movies because they provide an emotional power that people might not even understand, right? Yep. A shape or a composition that makes the audience feel a certain way. Without having to be explicit about it, you know, mm-hmm. like these things are obviously parts of film.
Yeah.
But what do they mean? What are they intended to do? How dark are those intentions? I think there's a lot of debate about that.
Well, that's kind of what's cool about a movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that there is no guidebook to the actual interpretation of what's being presented, right? There's, mm-hmm. there isn't actually a guide. There's attempts at guidebooks at like a movie like Apocalypse Now, right? But ultimately, like those representations can be. You can interpret them whatever way you want. And then there's some films that are intentionally leaning into that thing, like 2001, right? And the monolith and this being this like thing that is not entirely clearly defined.
Right.
Which I think that the big part of what the monolith in 2001 is something for the audience to pour themselves into. In
exactly.
Sense, right. So that's the thing. That's kind of how I feel about that stuff is like, if you want to, whatever you want to believe in, you can look into a work of art to pull the interpretation that you're looking for in the first place.
Yeah.
And
some people are real creative with this.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially, look, it's like anything else. Like, you put time into it. Like, if I'm convinced that, you know, I don't know, take whatever kind of fun conspiracy theory you want about the movie business, that they're all pedophiles or something like this.
Yeah.
If I'm convinced of that thing, I can most certainly go back through every film that I've ever seen and in high detail kind of put together the argument and construct.
Absolutely. No, I mean, the one of the greatest examples that I think my audience would be familiar with is, I forget if it's called The Shining Code or something like yeah. that. There's a bizarre scene in the 1980 Stanley Kubrick film, The Shining,
mm-hmm.
where Danny is playing with some toys on a carpet.
That looks like the launch pad.
That looks like the Apollo launch pad. He does stand up. He's wearing a homemade sweater that says Apollo 11 on it. He goes to room 237. I think I'm remembering the number correctly. Mm-hmm. It is roughly 237,000 miles from the Earth to the Moon. After he leaves room 237, he will no longer talk. He will no longer talk about what he saw there or what mm-hmm. happened there. This, of course, is Stanley Kubrick confessing.
Yeah,
that,
obviously.
Obviously.
It's actually a really heavy-handed confession. And if you're kind of denying that, I mean, you're just denying in the face of evidence.
Now, I love this. I want this to be true more than anything. Like, if I could, you know, click my heels and make this true, I would, this is, and we did a show back in 2012 or 2013 about conspiracy theories, right? Yeah. And, you know, I talked about, you know, that emotional power that draws people to wanting to believe this thing. It speaks to what you're saying, because then somebody took this scene and said, this obviously means something, right? Mm-hmm. And Kubrick was doing all these weird things that might have just been like obvious continuity errors where, you know, you'd see like a long, kind of a long shot of the interior of the hotel, and there'd be like the furniture in the background would be arranged a certain way, and then it cuts away and cuts back and the furniture is arranged different. And they'd say, he's too meticulous for those kind of continuity errors, so he's trying to say something with this. Might have just been trying to create disorientation, right? Like the actual hotel, if you kind of tried to map the hotel as you see it in the movie,
it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. There's windows where there shouldn't be windows. So it creates this unease. It creates this unease in the audience as they watch the film. But people can read into all of those things as somebody did with this thing. I think it is called The Shining Code, where the guy using the springboard of the Apollo 11 Danny stands up scene, he goes, now, look in this room. See all these doorways? What is on the side of either door? One. In the frames of the door, making two ones. For what? Apollo 11. Here's an A, you know, on this coffee can in the cooler,
right?
You know, going in with this laser focus, basically going through this process of confirmation bias to pull out every possible piece of evidence, no matter how weak this is a story.
You'll find it.
So you scale that up to
a Kubrick movie.
What's that?
Movie sets can be so chaotic and things like that. Kubrick is so meticulous and specific.
Legendarily, to
apply that to the rest of the film business.
Yeah, but I think that's where things there's a documentary called Room 237.
Okay, yeah, there's that too.
Have you seen this?
I have seen that. I've seen all of
these.
So
it just, I wish, if I ever meet these people, I'm sorry. I wish it was done a little better, in which it like dealt with each conspiracy one at a time, so that you can see the narrative, because that's what's really interesting to me about conspiracy theories is to see the like narrative that like spawns them.
Yeah.
So like, what's the underlying thing? Like, what's your, you know, distrust of the state and NASA, right? Or like, or the sciences, right? In some way can like lead you to like Kubrick faked the moon landing for NASA that had like this great national objective and yada, yada, yada. By the way, just really quick, my favorite side note to that conspiracy is why Kubrick faked the moon landing was to get a lens to shoot Barry Lyndon.
For Barry Lyndon, the low light Zeiss lens.
What a low stakes game.
Well, see, I thought that was his reward.
Yeah, that was his reward. Like, that's what he did it for.
Oh, he had that plan the whole time. He's like, I gotta make this film. Super slow movie about Victorian England, and I gotta light it by candlelight.
Oh, it's the best. I gotta light it by candlelight if I want it to look like the way it looks like in those paintings.
Absolutely.
In those museums.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna fake the moon landing, obviously.
NASA's the only person who can help me.
Yep.
You know, wow.
Hey, NASA, what do you guys need? I need this lens that works. Tell me, what are you guys up to in here?
Exactly. Yeah. Great. That's so I've only ever heard it presented as a reward that NASA offered to him after. This Kubrick playing the long game of someday I need to make this movie.
Yeah.
And I need this lens. How do I get it?
Oh, Barry Lyndon, you know.
Oh, I love that even better. Oh, that's right. Because he was trying to make the Napoleon movie.
Yeah, it was too big. Yeah. Too much money.
He was also working on a Holocaust movie.
He was working on a Holocaust movie. And then he also did, AI was the thing that he was doing before he passed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever hear the Kubrick quote about Schindler's List?
No, but what is it?
I think he says, the Holocaust is about 6 million people that died. Schindler's List was about 600 people that lived.
Yeah.
That's wow.
Yeah. But I think the whole reason he didn't do the Holocaust movie was because of Schindler's List.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And, he was pretty close with Spielberg. And Schindler's List is, you know,
it's
well done.
It's, yeah.
You know, good luck, Kubrick.
It works.
I know he's the best, but Schindler's List is like great film.
It's an amazing film. It is an absolutely amazing film.
But I think what Bowers was saying was it's a little unfair with Kubrick, and I think why all of these conspiracies come out of the world of Kubrick because he's so notoriously controlled, or at least the perception is as well, that he can controlled every single bit and frame and everything that happened within the frame so perfectly.
Indeed.
That of course everything in there has this deep intentional meaning.
Yeah.
But the thing that I find completely absurd about even this statement, right? Because you can't apply that to the rest of the film business. You can't apply that to every mayonnaise commercial that you see on TV that you are convinced is a coded message to, pass on Satanism to your children.
Right.
So even Kubrick, who's the guy that's so specific, right? And there's no mistakes. There's nothing that's a mistake left in his frames because it's all supposed to be this encoded image.
Yeah.
The opening shot
of in
The Shining.
Oh, yeah.
Has a helicopter shadow in it.
Yeah.
From the helicopter that they're shooting off of.
Absolutely.
It's like an egregious mistake that probably cost too much time and too much money to redo. And this perfectionist had to go, ah, fuck it.
But there's even theories about that, right? I mean, because that
is all. How could he leave it in there?
Exactly. Why is the helicopter?
What does the helicopter mean?
Notice how the shadow is black. What is he trying to tell
us?
Everything.
It's black.
Right? Black helicopters.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, no, I've definitely seen that explored too. The famous, but now, could there be a reason why the helicopter shadow is there? I could not think 100%. Of one. But
just because that's the time of day that they had to shoot the shot. they liked
so
looking.
Many things boil down to.
Yeah. Yeah. We both work with a number of people who have worked with the Coen brothers and stuff.
Yeah.
I had heard a story from a close friend who had worked on Barton Fink, which is awesome movie. And then there's this huge USO dance number kind of scene in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
And this could all be a silly story, but it sounds in line with other stories that I've heard about these directors. But it's just there's a water main bust where they're shooting, and there's water, a pipe bursts right above their set.
Oh,
and it's
damn.
Pouring water everywhere.
Yeah.
And they're looking at in this one direction because it's a small scene in a movie on a budget. So they're only really planning on looking one way to shoot this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only direction that they're supposed to be looking in is now being drenched and rained upon, and it's going to be a complete and utter mess. They can't shoot. So they move everything. The Coen brothers discuss it, think about it, look at the context of their day, what else they could possibly shoot. And they're like, okay, move all the furniture from one side of the room that's covered in rain to the other side of the room, and then we'll just have to shoot it this way.
Yeah.
So it's great. I think this is a good segue into the everyday of making a movie too, but it's a lot of a job of a director in a lot of instances is just being a problem solver to figure out how to make the film when it isn't precisely and exactly what it is that they envisioned in those frames, which is something that just happens.
It's constant compromise.
Not to bust anybody's bubble about their favorite directors and all of these kind of moments of, oh my, did you see how Scorsese orchestrated everything in that frame?
Mm-hmm. No, certainly there are times when he does and it's successful, but the idea that, one of the things that we're going to talk about today, and I'll just kind of preview it now, is that there's not only a lot of compartmentalization on a film set that sort of breaks down the theory of, a massive coordinated effort to present some kind of a message, right?
Yes.
Because things are very compartmentalized on a film set.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, and it works in a very sort of industrial, factory floor kind of process.
Yes.
Despite being perceived as a very creative industry. So we'll get into that part as well. And there was one more aspect to that having to do with directors, that it speaks to the sort of fluidity and the creativity of these people, but because things can change very quickly, especially I would guess if you're doing anything involving nature or locations, you're leaving a lot of things to chance.
Yep.
So, you know, there is that creativity, but there's also a major amount of regimentation that might surprise a lot of people.
I think it would. There's a lot of regimentation, and it's most certainly, it's a necessary thing. And I think this is kind of the genesis of why we got together a little bit.
Yeah.
Talking about when we met, a little bit how I thought the stuff you talk about here on the show about regimentation, school being made, you know, an apparatus to make good citizens and good workers.
Right, right.
Is, I think, kind of exactly what is exactly the way that a film set works is comparable to, you know, an assembly line in a factory.
I agree. And I think, like, we should actually return. This was an awesome tangent we've been doing for about 20 yeah. minutes, but we should return to the POV that you guys each have.
Sure.
Like, up to date right now. So you each have very interesting stories about how you've worked your way through this industry to the positions you're currently in, starting as PAs in both mm-hmm. cases, right?
Yep. Yeah.
But to talk about the perspective you're seeing the set and the production from now, I think is really interesting. So you're here, Dutch, working on a project in Pittsburgh. Scott, you're just visiting and not working on the same project. But
I'm on a movie in New York.
You're on a movie in New York. But you guys did work together on a film in New Orleans, mm-hmm. right? Can we say anything about that, like genre?
I don't even know what genre.
I don't know.
I think it's just a drama.
It's a drama.
It's a drama.
It has a historical figure, a historical figure.
Yeah, I don't think I can say anything about it yet because it's not quite press time for that film yet.
Okay.
It still has.
We don't have to say any details about the film. I'm like,
yeah.
Genre, and maybe that it was a period piece. Is that
yeah,
okay?
Yeah, that works.
All right. So you guys.
Maybe when it is press time, I can come back.
Indeed. Oh, you have to come back for many press times, please. Okay. Both of you, actually. You're Dutch, the first assistant director. Scott, you're the second assistant. Can mm-hmm. you, starting with Scott, just talk about what that meant, what your role was, what you did on this project?
As a second AD?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the AD...
Which works pretty universally, I think, for every project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. The AD department really deals with logistics and information.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the first AD runs the set and creates a schedule. Me as the second AD, and this is, I think, the same for Europe and America, the second AD is working on the future, not as much as the present. So my role is like, I'm usually one of the first to arrive, you know, catch hair and makeup, you know, costumes, actors, if they're going to like get ready before a crew call,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then, you know, I'm not the person that actually puts them into the chair, you know, in the hair, makeup chair, costumes, anything like that. Like I monitor it.
Right.
But then, once the day starts going, I'm usually working on the future. I'm working on tomorrow. I'm working on 2 days from now.
I mean, you mean like working on the future? I think
future of the movie.
Yeah. You're working on organizing.
Yeah.
And sort of directing efforts of different crews to what is essentially on the docket for the next day's work in a really, really nuts and bolts, highly specific way.
Yeah, one thing that the second AD creates is called a call sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And I create the first half of the day and sometimes the second half of the day. It's like I create, it's called a preliminary call sheet for tomorrow's work.
Okay.
And then at the end of the night,
but can you tell? You might want to tell people what a call sheet is.
Oh yeah, so
you do spend. You do, Scott. You spend probably 7-8 hours a day, but also yeah. years of work into yeah. your specific format of your call sheet. He's very
yes.
proud of his call sheet.
Yeah, and we like vocab too. So
call sheet,
yeah, please. Yeah.
So yeah, one thing the second AD creates is called a call sheet, and the call sheet. I mean, they're all different, but for the most part, the top of it has like information, like what's the crew call time. You know, what call time is the general crew
what
call.
What time does everybody have
yeah,
to show up to work?
Does everybody show up? You've got the work for the day,
mm-hmm.
the scenes, the scene number, the description of the scene, the actors that are in the scene, the story day, the amount of pages that the scene is, the locations.
Now, how many people are you, and this maybe transitions into your role as the first AD, Dutch, mm-hmm. a little bit too. How many people are you coordinating with, Scott, to put that together? Everybody?
Pretty much everybody. Well, so you have like three parts to a movie process. The way I think about it is you got preparing, prep,
yeah.
shooting, and post.
Okay.
And so I would be coordinating mostly with people in the actual making of the movie. The people who are like feet are on the ground, boots on the ground.
Right.
They're like there for the shooting.
So you guys are both primarily involved. Like you seem, Dutch, like you have a little bit more in the prep.
Mm-hmm.
But
I have a longer prep.
Right.
And I work, I essentially well, we don't necessarily have to get into this too much, but there's kind of like different kinds of first ADs, and there's like, you know, there's like producers' first ADs that are hired by producers, and there's directors' first ADs that are hired by directors. Either way, you're supposed to be either one of those parties, like right hand on the shop floor. So I think it's important to kind of put it in this context. Is everything that we do, me and Scott, it pertains to running the shop floor on the day. And what I mean by the shop floor is the set.
Right? Okay.
It's like where the assembly of, where the assembly, if a movie is a
car.
The
movie factory.
Yeah, yeah, in the movie factory. It's like we are kind of organizing the efforts of all of the different compartmentalized positions, as you're saying, like mm-hmm. a movie is so very compartmentalized, right? So our main function, and you can kind of see it illustrated by Scott describing his call sheet, right, is to inform all of those people that are working on making the car, making the movie.
Right.
At what point and in which time different parts of that process are going to take place so that we can kind of coordinate something, a really, really small movie, like the smallest movie I've ever worked on in scale, right, was a 15-person crew. And the largest movie I've ever worked on in scale is probably...
Don't even know.
I mean, when you include things like extras,
yeah.
even if it's a day where you have like 200 or 300 extras, you
yeah.
could be talking about coordinating...
Like 1,500 people.
Yeah.
Sometimes on real, real big ones.
On a real, real big movie, yeah. I mean, it can get really... Just to put it into context, I guess, I Am Legend.
Yeah.
Big-timey film in that shot in New York that I think we both may...
I did not work on it.
Okay. It employed every single PA person in the film business from like everywhere in the tri-state area and then some, and people from LA, because it was just such a massive kind of scale production.
Yeah.
So if you were alive and in New York or in... anywhere around there when that movie was being filmed, you got a call for it because it just needed every single like hand on deck, basically.
Really?
Yeah, I must
be misremembering. I picture Will Smith, a dog, and a bunch of CGI.
Correct. Will Smith, a dog, and an empty Times
it's
Square.
It's making in New York.
Okay, that's what it did. It.
Yeah, making New York with, empty is hard. Yeah,
no, that's
with grass. With grass that had overtaken the middle of Times Square because it had been abandoned by humanity for so long.
I just figured it took all people CGI to put grass.
Not back then.
So they shot most of it practically and then they went back and like enhanced most of it in CG.
Yeah.
But erasing like pedestrians is hard.
Yeah. And costly, right? But just what got us onto this tangent a little bit is so our department on that, and me and Scott, neither me or Scott was the head of this department, you didn't work on it, and I was like, I worked on it for like a day in like a very, you know, small and meaningless way.
Mm-hmm.
But I know people that I'd worked on in the whole shoot, and there were days where our department alone, right, would be something like 125 people.
Wow.
Just because they were doing shots that, you know, looked up 6th Avenue, where there's all these abandoned, rusted cars parked all over the place.
Yeah.
And there's all this like grass growing on 6th Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a sequence where Will Smith was like chasing, hunting a deer.
Yes. Yeah.
So it just required all of these like really big scale shots where you saw up 6th Avenue in the middle of the day, which is another like critical story element, which mm-hmm. I won't say too much about more about because of spoilers and things in case anyone there hasn't seen I Am Legend. But,
right.
Yeah, the scale of trying to organize the efforts of, just think about it in these terms, keeping people out of the shot.
Right.
Required, like, you know, well over 100 bodies in one department. Then there's a locations department. And then you got to get all the stuff that you have to get there to shoot anyway, which is a whole other thing. But that is what we do, right? So from a scale of whether it's 15 people on a movie or whether it's a scale of 2,000 people on a movie on any given day,
mm-hmm.
our job, in essence, is to coordinate the efforts of all of those different individual people, but also individual departments to be able to be in the right place at the right time to execute what a director is hoping and a production is hoping to execute.
To put into the frame what the director wants.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the way I nutshelled it for people after when I was telling the story that I met these two guys in New Orleans, they work together as a team, and they basically, you tell me if I'm giving you too much credit or not enough, they basically put everything in place for the actor, the director to come in and direct the actors.
Yeah, not quite. I don't think quite everything. It's more.
Or
like,
they coordinate. They're not the guys actually physically putting everything in place, but there's
a whole other layer of people behind us, too, right? That will get all the contracts signed, make sure that the equipment actually exists and is in our possession, right?
Like the art department and the. Like all the set dressing and whatnot is there.
Well, I'm even saying
the schedule that's created.
Right.
I'll even say take it one step back further from that, Scott, is like securing the financing, the insurance, the infrastructure. Like I show up on the first day of a job for me, and there's an office with a desk, and a chair, and electricity, and the internet, and copiers, and like this whole big thing that has been pushed through, right? Where it's like, hey, we have this movie and this movie star, which has allowed us to raise $50 million, that somebody secures that and does that. This is what a producer does. And then the production, basically the production department, which is like, they're the coordinators of getting all of the stuff to like exist in front of you. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then after we have all this stuff, trucks, actors,
locations.
An art department to build sets and a locations department to be able to go out and scout locations.
And you work then with them as well.
Then we come in and then it's like, okay, now here's the schedule that we're going to make. Here's the order in which we need to be scouting locations. Art department, this is the order in which you should be building the sets because this is the order in which they're going to play.
Because
based on a shot schedule.
These actors are only available for these weeks.
Yeah. My
this
goodness.
This location's only available for this time.
We do puzzles for a living, basically.
Well, that's what I was thinking. You know, when you were talking, and we were talking about this contrast between, like, you have highly creative people, right, in the form of actors and directors, and, of course, all of these people who do design, all put together in this sort of contrasting factory model, right? Yep. But is there any other way that something like this could run? I mean, it seems like that amount of regimentation, it's almost kind of an interesting contradiction, but it seems like that amount of regimentation is needed to get, you know, the creative product.
Yeah, it is an interesting contradiction, and I think it's also just a contradiction to people's perception of the business, right?
Yeah.
Which is that it's like loose and freewheeling and fun, and everyone's like doing cocaine and like drinking all the time, and it's like Hollywood parties and all that fun stuff, right?
I will say that when you showed up to work on your next project here in this city,
yeah,
I did, and this was just a function of knowing you less than I know you now. I said, "Why does he seem so relaxed about all this?"
Oh.
You seem like you really had a lot ahead of you and you were really taking it in stride. Well, I mean, maybe it's experience, but
the AD department is notoriously stressful.
Oh, and yeah.
A lot of assistant directors are, I mean, what is it? There's that statistic. I don't think it's true. That statistic that
I don't think it's true any longer, but for
DGA
a while,
members die at like 53
it was
or 56 something.
56 years old was the average age of death for a first assistant director. But I don't think it was a made up number. I just don't think it's true anymore.
You ever see the Kids in the Hall skit where the guy has seven things to do today and he's running around and he's got a list and he keeps going, I've got seven things to do today. And he's checking them off as he
That's
goes, just knocked over an old lady, just knocked over an old lady. Keep going. You got six things to do today.
That is Scott's life.
Kevin McDonald.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with this?
I used to watch I don't remember the particular skit, but I did used to watch Kids in the Hall every day after school.
This is me with like four things.
Right.
Right. Now it depends on what they are. Sometimes I love to make a checklist and check those boxes. Like that's.
It'd be a good AD.
But if it was 100 things.
It is.
It's 100 things.
My friend Andrew, who was just here hanging out with us before we started, he's always making fun of me. He's like, if Brett has anything to do, he can't do,
do anything else.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, I do feel bad. Yeah, I get off the phone an invitation to go on an adventure. And I say, I can't. I can't do it. I've got coffee to make and a thing to edit. And it seems like once I started to understand the scope of your jobs, it seemed very quickly overwhelming to me just because it's like, I don't mind having a lot to do if all of these things are sort of interconnected pieces that make sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, we would help make sense of them.
That's the thing, is that putting that puzzle together,
yeah,
right? Because like I could say like, well, all of these things are on this list because, you know, they serve my life in some way.
Right.
But then when you're dealing with personalities, right? So I was talking to
that's where I make the money. It's the person who's dealing with personalities.
Yeah, exactly.
Truly.
Yeah, that is true. That's not how I make my money.
I know this is how we wanted to talk about this a bit, and it's good. It is that because there is the kind of industrialization of, I mean, it's like movies came out of that time, right?
Yeah.
And then and that's where the studio time comes out of. And it's like everything's made. The process is such that it allows for a high maximum amount of efficiency.
Right? Yeah, right.
And it's a pretty, this is really good and really bad. And it's really bad, good and bad for lots of different reasons. But anywhere you go in the country, for the most part, if you're working on an IATSE production or like a union film.
What did you, an IATSE?
IATSE is like the stagehands and technicians union.
Okay.
And kind
okay.
of like all of the, from camera people to production designers and across the board. Except everyone
studio
except for
mechanics.
Studio mechanics is what they, that's the basic handle.
Okay.
There is a pretty much like universal outline, which we can go over today. So mm-hmm. I think it's good for anybody that's really interested in making movies to know what that process is. But it exists pretty much across the board. And you would think that means that it's like an exact science and that it's just been nailed down.
Yeah.
And this is the best way to do things. But the things that actually really make that more tricky than not is personalities, temperaments.
That's it. And I was saying to somebody yesterday about, you know, running a small business, right? This guy was doing it. I'm doing it. I try to minimize the amount of people that I have to deal with,
mm-hmm.
you know, just because and picking the right people and building solid relationships with those people. Because if you have to deal with like 100 people, forget it. Like this guy was, in real estate, right? Mm-hmm. So he's got GCs and workers and lawyers and, you know, you're creating so many variables for so many things to go wrong. Yeah. Now you're talking about this in the context of Hollywood mm-hmm. and unions. Mm-hmm. And I could see that would be something where there would be, and that's not any kind of a judgment against anybody, actors or unions or sure. anything, but there's lots of variables. There's lots of competing needs.
Yeah,
and to mediate that, good heavens. Good
competing, competing priorities and necessities.
Competing priorities.
Is a really hard thing. What is the priority for the Teamsters on the set may not be the same priorities as the directors.
Mm-hmm.
May not be the same priorities as the location manager, right? Perfect example. I'm here, and this is not a specific example, right? But I am here on a production that is constituted of most of the higher ups, in a vague way to put it, are from out of town. We are from New York or LA,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is generally the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
We will come and we will hire local crews, including one key position that you always is a lot of the times you have you need locals, right?
Right.
Which
yeah.
is the locations manager, who's going to manage the physical, practical locations that your company is going to be shooting in, right? Let's just say you are a director and you're shooting an action movie in a town like Pittsburgh and you want to throw a car off a bridge, right? Nice.
Yeah.
That's cool. You're not a resident of the city. You think it's great. It's part of your movie, right?
Not enough cars in the water, you say.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Your priority as the director and what's important to you and the location manager's priorities with the people that are involved with the throwing of a car off the bridge are totally different. And here's the really quick, simple reason why. The director is going to make his film there or her film there. And then they're going to publicly, probably to their crew, be like, oh yeah, my next movie's in San Diego or my next film's in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. Right. And what that you're illustrating essentially is that you are not here and you are not a part of this community as a long-term staple.
Yeah.
The locations manager lives here. Has to deal with every out-of-town person that comes through the city.
Yeah.
Right? And if they let every person from LA or New York do whatever they want to do and burn down every house, and,
you right, know, like, right, man, yeah,
right, they're going to be the person that the locals do not want to talk to or interact with. Hey, that location manager is a liar and a swindler and does terrible things, and he's working for the this director wanted to throw three cars in the river, and this location manager let him. Right,
right, you know,
even though they knew it was going to be bad for the city in the long term, they're trying to get the quick money into town.
Right.
A lot of my job is trying to reconcile relationships like that, right? Which is like, these people have totally different priorities. The location manager wants to do a good job for the director, right? But they want to do a good job for all directors that come to town and want there to be locations that you can shoot in, because this movie, three movies ago, did not ruin this beautiful museum in the city of Pittsburgh when they shot there that did irreparable damage. The location manager lets some kind of irreparable damage happen to like something that's very important institution or something. They probably won't ever be able to film in there again. And that hurts their reputation as an individual in a city.
Absolutely. I mean, so I was I took a year off from college to do an internship with my uncle's business. My uncle's a film producer. Mm-hmm. And he and his partner had started the process to make the movie A Civil Action, which mm-hmm. I think came out in the
mid-90s, right?
95?
Possibly. It was shortly after that. I think I was working for him in like 1998. So it was around the time. So they had actually gotten the ball rolling on A Civil Action. And I won't say which studio or production company it was, but they were interested in producing a sort of underlying, more controversial story. This was, my uncle grew up in Woburn, Massachusetts, where, and so did his partner, where this, I think it was called the Grace Chemical Company, the focus.
I've heard of this because I've worked near there on a film.
Dumped all this stuff in the river. Mm-hmm. And then the lawyer that Travolta played in the movie was kind of the person who spearheaded getting justice, if I'm remembering the story correctly. So this was a project they were very passionate about, and they got the ball rolling on it. And then the studio wound up going into the town and trying to dig stuff up about people who had lived there at that time. Right. And found it to be, it caused a lot of conflict. It, mm-hmm. it caused a major disruption. And my uncle and his partner wound up walking away from the project entirely. So they're not, they started that, but they're not credited. They handed it off to somebody. They would have been the, production
company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. On that.
Yeah. That's,
so I'm guessing there are, if I dare, men who just want to watch the world burn. Type people who don't care about those relationships because they're just passing through.
Or they think that their film is more important than those relationships.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Like, there's a certain amount of ego that goes into anything. And, everyone's always convinced that their film, not everyone, but a lot of the times, that their film is, like, really big, really important. It's going to be a cultural touchstone. Or it's going to have some amount of value that is so great that it's worth cracking a few eggs.
Sure.
To make an omelet.
Make that omelet, yeah.
Yeah. There's definitely a fair share of that happens. No doubt about it.
So have you guys had to like mediate those situations and you have to say, look.
Depends on the scale of it.
Okay.
It's honestly, unlike the day-to-day stuff, like if we're shooting by a business in New York, it's not necessarily.
I think I probably feel a little bit more of that than you do as far as trying to reconcile. Directors ask, right? Because this is the position I find myself in often, is whenever there's a thing that a locations person, costumes, different departments are asking for some kind of like leniency on, right?
Yeah.
Like before they go to the producers, they'll be like, hey, Dutch, can you talk to the director about how many picture cars we need or how big this shot on this bridge is supposed to be or whatever it is, I'm usually the first level of go between,
right?
Between trying to broker some kind of thing with the director, or hey, we can close down this bridge, but we can only close down this bridge from 10 to 4 p.m. How can we limit our coverage in such a way that we can be able to do that and fit it into the day, and not have to ask the city to extend that into rush hour because it's going to affect the locations manager's relationship with the Department of Justice or the Department of Transportation in the particular town and the police force, which we are going to need for the rest of the film. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like, that's kind of like a common case that I'll make. Like, you know, you, if we blow past our permit time, it may have repercussions for us down the road. So it's just like, what I try and do most of the time is always make sure that these things that people have that are concerns in any sort of way are just being heard. Because if you can talk about it, if you can mention it, then you can talk about it, and you can talk about it, you can kind of solve it, I think, when it comes to most problems.
So, and Scott, you do some of this, right? This is certainly...
Yeah, not so much. I'm not so much on the front lines.
No, you do more of that, I would say. You're being coy about it a little bit, but I think you do way more of that when it comes to handling actors, handling hair, makeup, and handling wardrobe.
Yeah.
And their, all of their needs and their conflicts. Of, here's a common one, right? That you probably field all the time. An actor desires to not get into their costume before they do their hair, let's just say, for example.
Yeah.
But the hair department would like them in their costume before they get their hair done.
Right? Okay.
So you might have a situation where the actor, the hair person, and the costume person have three different interests. Let's just say they all want to be seen first, or they want to be seen second in the assembly line.
Okay.
Their priorities. Of
getting an actor ready, getting an actor from rolling out of bed to looking like the character that they're playing.
Yeah.
You run into that conflict
every day.
Okay, so there you go. So that's something that you have to mediate.
True, just not in like a location's respect.
Every single day. No, but it's the same. It's, I think it's the same thing, on, but just on a different scale. But these are the types of problems that we run into all the time. Most of the time, this is what I always hope for out of a crew, is everyone wants to do an amazing job.
Right.
So the director thinks that they're, or the producers are like, oh my God, this person's so good at their job. They're invaluable. I want to bring them on every movie I ever do for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Right. So they all want to do really good. And that sometimes puts people at an odds with other people also wanting to do really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just like, for me, like a big part of this is just like what we do is just brokering the kind of deals between the different departments to let them kind of coexist. And you deal with it more in the world of actors and hair makeup and logistics of, hey, how many vans do we need tomorrow? And how many times can we, you know, where can we park the trucks? And mine is more of, you know, we just did a shot. We just shot a shot of Brett's close up here. And now we're going to shoot my close up. And to do that, we have to look in the opposite direction. That means this table's got to come out here, and all this podcast equipment's got to be taken out to make room for the camera to come in.
Right.
And then it's got to all be brought back in and then reinstated. And it's like, okay, the order in which things are done is then for me to kind of have to work out with those departments. And it's like the camera always wants to be there first, and the lighting guys always want to have the set first.
The table has to be built where it can be
seen. Where it can be seen. But like it needs to, all of that needs to be kind of negotiated in real time in the most efficient way.
Just like to point out, just because you used the table, this is a very special table.
Beautiful table, right?
Table actually has a hatch in it for different camera setups. Because the table is so big and kind of cumbersome, originally this hatch was here because we realized we're never usually using this space. So sometimes this hatch is dropped and there's actually cameras in between here in the past. But this table was built this way because it was in a small room. And it was so large that the person who owned the studio wanted a pass-through, so they didn't have to walk all the way around the table.
Ah.
And then we found this was actually very useful for dropping that and putting cameras in there, and you could never tell that the cameras just appeared to be like free-floating because you couldn't
delightful.
See. Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing where, like, if I or a production designer is good at my job and we know we're shooting in a tight space, right? It's like interior radio studio.
Some hatches.
Put some hatches in, and hey guys, you know what's going to happen when we shoot this scene? Is everyone's going to get into a log jam and funnel, and it's going to be terrible. You know, it'd be great hatch.
Exactly. Right. So, you know,
it'd be great second door that we cut into the hole of this building.
I just want to insert this before we get too far away. People ask me about, like, what is School Sucks? What do you do? I say, we try to teach the skills that school does not.
Yep.
Right. We're hitting on so many of those, right? Mm-hmm. Organization, coordination, negotiation, communication, problem solving, critical thinking. Very little of that is taught in school.
Correct.
I would say at any level. Mm-hmm. You guys must have hacks or approaches that you take frequently to, let's say, let's just pick negotiation. Like I'm fascinated by you just from watching you and hanging out with you over the last month and a half, how serene you are all the time.
I'm a pretty calm, happy guy.
You are, right? Despite juggling and trying to coordinate a tremendous number of disparate things. Mm. So, yes, what's the secret? I want to know. But first, let's just, since we're talking about sort of conflicts and personalities, can you guys each talk about, you know, the negotiation strategies? I actually have a roundtable coming up on crucial communication and negotiation later this month. Based on this book called Never Split the Difference that I read recently and got a bunch of other guys to read. So we're going to do a show about it.
Oh, that's cool.
But has something emerged as like a set of rules emerge for you in these situations? Because you're each talking about it from different – you're maybe dealing with the Dutch on a bit of a larger scale since you have to like director to community or location manager to people who have concerns about locations not related to the film. Well, Scott, you're focusing more on the coordination between departments in the film. But
for tomorrow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, so how do you approach one of these situations? You know, what's the sort of the footing that you use to go into this, or does it, are there no
I've never really
rules?
Thought about this. So this is a really awesome
question. You got it all figured out. So I wanted to know how you guys do it.
I do it very just honestly and clearly, because if you're trying to negotiate something and you have like an agenda. But if you have an agenda, like chances are the people that you're talking with have been doing this long enough. They know your agenda, or they're going to find out your agenda.
So put it on the table.
That's one of the things that I just put it on the table.
So what would be an example of your agenda in like one of these situations?
Oh,
or is that obvious? It's just like, look, I'm trying to smooth this over and get on to the next thing.
My agenda is pretty much always trying to make the trains run on time.
Nice.
Okay, good.
I didn't know there would be Mussolini references. Yeah.
No, nicely done. I'm kidding. But like, I'm trying to get I would be negotiating to get everything in front of the camera in a timely fashion to get the director what they want.
Mm-hmm. Can I throw at you a regular one that maybe you can tell Brett that how you would navigate your way out of this one? Because I'm actually kind of curious because I never see you do it. I just know that it happens.
Hmm.
So we have a thing called turnaround.
Turnaround.
At the end of the night, the crew and the actors, depending on which union you are in, right, will have a certain amount of predetermined time off that cannot be breached.
Like for actors, traditionally it's 12 hours, like principal actors.
So if you finish at 3 o'clock in the morning, you cannot work until 3 p.m. the next day.
Okay, I got you. Okay?
That actor.
That actor, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with the crew. We will constantly be in a situation where we look at our schedule and it'll be scenes that are daylight outside.
Mm-hmm.
So when the sun sets, there is no chance of us being able to shoot daytime outside being like a really, really huge thing that you would have to know for months ahead of time that you're shooting daytime outside. And even so, it's just not done that often because it's hard to make it look good and it probably costs you just jillions of dollars to do it. So Scott will be in a situation where I'll say, hey, Scott, sun sets at 6:30 tomorrow and I need, you know, the full 12 hours that we have budgeted to work this day. So I need the actors in at 6:30 and I need them ready at 7. And then we'll be in a position where, you know, it's right now currently 5:42 and I will push it out to Bowers and I'll be like, how do we get these three actors ready for tomorrow morning in the appropriate amount of time? And I feel like your first thing is you'll always come back with, just because we're running this example, is you would usually say to me, can you not rehearse in the morning?
Yeah.
Can you? But usually there's like a ton of, I feel, or maybe this is just stuff that you're doing to make yourself look good to me, so I'll hire you again. But
Probably not.
What goes on back there when you're trying to wrangle like getting three different actors ready all on a turnaround?
I would just like to point out too, because a lot of people don't know this and probably haven't looked you guys up on IMDb, maybe at this point in the show. We've been very vague about what you guys have worked on.
Sure.
And a lot of that has to do with like non-disclosure agreements you have. It's why we're not talking about current projects or even recent projects. But we're talking about doing this with the most famous people, right?
Sure.
Just to kind of color this in a little bit better.
Yeah.
We can
do a better job of that. I mean, we've definitely, let's just take a stab at it. Like productions that you would have seen in like 2000 plus movie theaters in the country or like a network television show or something like that. How many titles do you think we have between the two of us?
Probably almost 100.
I mean, I have close to 100.
Oh, well, on IMDb, I think I have like 30 something credits as
we're talking.
AD.
We're talking about we're yeah.
And so, but there's a difference. Is that like again, like you know, you're talking about you worked a couple of days on I Am Legend.
Sure,
that's a credit.
Yeah,
yeah.
But then doing a movie from begin to end as a first AD, which takes like 5 months, that is one credit as well.
Correct.
But so you know, how many movies have we worked on beginning to end?
Beginning to end. That are movies that you or audience or anyone may have heard of?
Yeah.
Between you and I don't know. 40?
Yeah, 40 or 50 at least.
Okay. Could we...
At least, yeah.
You guys can say no and I can edit this part out.
Sure.
Can you each name a film that you are particularly proud of being a part of? Or, you know, it could be 10 years old.
I don't know. I feel like if I do that and someone hears this, that they might feel bad that I didn't say their movie. You know what I mean?
I understand.
Because there's actually, I will say, there are a lot of films that I am like dearly passionate about that I've worked on that I was really, really close to. Mm-hmm. And this has actually happened to me in my life, like casually, where a producer has said to me, "Hey, Dutch, what films are some of your favorite movies you worked on?" And I just like kind of like, you know, casually answer. I'm like, "I really love this film and this film." And I've heard that the producer has talked to a director that I've worked with and mm-hmm. mentioned that I didn't say their film
wasn't on the list.
And they were like, and yeah, and it's been a thing that's been awkward for me in the past, which is directors or producers or anyone thinking that there was a project that I worked on that I took because I was really excited about it. But because I didn't mention it, they think I don't like it.
I gotcha. Maybe I could rephrase the question, right? Because that is a problem, right? That is very exclusionary, the way I ask the question. It's asking you to be exclusionary.
Yes.
Something that some part of your performance or your job function that you were particularly proud of.
Okay, that's cool.
Here, could you say it again?
So, like, you're working on some film. Some unique challenge presents itself to you. I don't know if you can go into details about what the challenge would have been, but something where you sort of persevered or wound up putting the pieces of a difficult puzzle together, and really that became like an asset to the production.
I
didn't think about it, and I'm really not sure.
I'd have to be an egomaniacal monster and just say that I feel like almost everything I work on
I like that
a critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I'm critical at all, but you know, like producers and directors will lean on us to figure out problems like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of what we get paid for.
Right.
So I don't know.
There's been many films that I've done that are like icy, icy, cold movies, like very set. And I did a film called Bluebird, another one called The Motel Life, and another one called Kimiko, The Treasure Hunter. And Kimiko, for instance, is a movie that I can say that I'm very proud of. And it's about a woman who's convinced that the money that Steve Buscemi buried in the movie Fargo exists, and she's out to find it. And this is a movie that went to Sundance and got distribution. It's an awesome movie. My task in all of those movies was to figure out how a company can function and operate in like negative 20 degree weather.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Minnesota in January. The other one was Reno in January. The other one was Maine, Northern Maine, Millinocket in January.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge on each of those films was the directors wanted it to be snowing, and we didn't have the money or the technology to make it snow without it actually being snowing.
I had a question about weather. Like, you need a rainy day, you need a sunny day, right? So okay.
My task on each one of these films, which came across in each one of those films, is there is falling snow in all of the scenes where we wanted there to be falling snow.
Okay.
And the whole way that I was able to bring that to a production in the way that they, you know, in the way that they wanted it to, was to make a schedule that was flexible enough, that was loose enough to allow for the accommodation of it snowing or allow us to go out and essentially chase the snow when it snowed.
See, and that is what I was thinking, is that sounds incredibly complex. Like, you know, what if you need a rainy day, you know?
And you need a sunny one and there's nothing but rain for a whole week?
Absolutely.
So you know,
and you only have people at certain times. I mean, those are problems that have to be solved.
Certain actors that are available at certain times. Yeah. These are all really...
Dutch is good at it, though.
So, yeah, and what do you think it is? Or maybe you need to answer this question. If you said you'd never thought about this, Dutch, maybe Scott needs to answer this question as an observer. And then we're going to – I'd like to do an anatomy of a scene in a movie that we've all seen that kind of maybe brings some of these safety concerns into question.
Yeah,
right?
And we should also – I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't give people the like, we're talking about so many specific things, but we should talk about how a normal day on set runs, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'd love it. We're doing two parts. And
oh, great. I love two-parters.
Yeah, this is how we're going to wrap up this part. So from observing Dutch do these negotiations and mediations, what would you say?
Well, you have been surprised at how relaxed Dutch is when you figure out how much he's kind of in charge of.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that is one of his skills, being relaxed, honestly.
Being chill.
Yeah, just being chill.
Netflix and chill over here.
Just his ability to calm people.
Oh, I could see it.
I don't know. I mean, in those specific situations that I've had like that, is what I would ask everyone to do is put their cards on the table. Why do you feel unsafe? Why do you think it's unsafe? And why do you think it is safe?
Mm-hmm.
Because most of the time when there's conflicts like this, I don't think people's natural inclination is to meet the conflict. I think, and I'm sure we can talk ad nauseum about why this is. Most people appeal to an adult.
Yeah.
This is what I do for a living. I am the adult of a movie set in a lot of ways, which is actually, you guys both know me in my personal life. Is terrifying. Yeah, ironic. Really ironic and terrifying.
But honestly, it's kind of funny you said adult, because that's actually a thing that's said within the film industry all the time.
Where
it's
like,
the adults are here. Or we need to ask
an adult on set. I've said it all the time. I've said it in response to get the producers to set. Because I will call Bowers on a walkie-talkie, and I'll be like, Bowers, I need an adult in here.
That's not a joke.
That means get me a producer.
Yeah.
Because this situation that we just described, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't reconcile this. We're actually at a point that maybe it can't be reconciled. I need a producer to come down here and make a decision and put a stamp on it and be the one that's responsible for this thing.
Let me ask you this, okay? something, a theme that we've explored, and there's other people doing it too, like Jonathan Haidt, right?
Mm-hmm. And who I am just a huge fan of his work.
But we've talked about
valuable.
This, yes, a lot on the show, is that, you know, well, we're trying to analyze some of the behavioral and emotional problems evidenced by the generation of people going through college right now, right? Millennials. There's many of these people on a film set. One of the things in needing an adult, like, we're probably all old enough. How old are you, Scott?
I'm 36.
36. I'm 41. You're 34, 33?
33.
Okay. We're all probably old enough to remember, like, playing alone. And a lot of people in that age group are not, you know, they've never been left
to
resolve their own problems, the social problem. There's always an adult hovering around, right? Have you noticed that this request for an adult is age group dependent in any way?
Absolutely not.
No. That's interesting. I like that.
People ask me. Again, when you think about what you know about me and my personal life.
Sure.
You think this is absurd. Grown men and women who are much older than I am even will ask me permission to use the bathroom. I've had 50 and 60 and 70 and 80-year-olds raise a hand on set and ask me to go to the bathroom. Had Academy Award winners ask me if I can use a toilet.
I mean, in your defense, in their defense, like, you're the person that's running the set, and you know if, like, between takes, there's time for them to do that.
Sure, but it is the way that it is, right? And there's different people in the business, and I can tell. I feel like I can tell a certain thing about them. They're the people who are, say, let me know when I can use the bathroom, and can I? Is a big difference.
You know what's funny, though, about, like, the whole adult thing? I was just thinking I've never heard a Teamster ask for
Teamsters
adult.
Don't ask for adults.
I've never heard a Teamster
Teamsters
say,
are an island unto their own. They are their own adults.
Yep.
Did you, in the private show that we did you tell the Teamster story? I think you did.
I think I did.
Okay. It's in the bonus.
You did. No, I heard it.
I did, I think,
Okay.
Real quick, on this part, are we going to talk about, like, the education required to work on a movie?
We'll do that in part two.
Part two.
I think we'll talk in part two. We're going to talk the day-to-day operation of a film set and the lack of formal education.
Oh, big time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You don't need
so
it.
So necessary.
So unnecessary.
Not
so
oh,
necessary
good, right.
to talk about. But so
oh, man. This is checking all the boxes that I wanted
good.
Perfect. So I feel like we both answered the mediation and negotiation question, or you both answered that question. Back to the safety thing. You and I, Dutch, were having dinner the other night, and we were talking about a scene in one of my favorite films of all time, The Dark Knight.
Ah, yes.
And the scene, there's a lot of debate online about this scene where the Joker, Heath Ledger, blows up the hospital.
Yes.
Right? Now, you would think that he back to first unit and second unit, right? A scene where Heath Ledger is going, boop, I've got a little detonator that I press a button, first unit, right? Then cut to something done at a totally different time, maybe
takes
in a totally different place.
Takes all
kaboom,
yeah.
right? And Heath Ledger is, you know, in another country
yes.
when that happens. This is definitely like second unit, big scale action type shit.
Type, yes.
But Heath Ledger is in the foreground.
I can well,
go for it. Go for it.
I can just tell you.
I'm so excited.
Christopher Nolan doesn't do second unit.
Okay, you're right.
He's a total boss, and he's awesome. And so he doesn't do second unit. He does first unit only, and he usually only has two cameras at once. But he's usually really only using one. So he doesn't do second
one
unit.
Super awesome 70mm IMAX camera or something crazy like that.
Yeah. Because, like, in big fight scenes, like, they're sometimes running two cameras. Christopher Nolan sometimes runs two cameras, but it's usually only one. He's a total general, total boss.
You can say this from experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, people, what can we...
So if your question is, if the debate, I don't know what the question, if the question or the debate is, was that second unit or was that a visual effect?
No. It's how was that done? Like, so there's lots of like first unit, second unit. What was Nolan doing? What was Heath Ledger
building.
Doing?
No,
what were they trying to do?
Adamant about
was
practical.
It safe?
Practical. Yeah, sure.
I bet you safe, it was safe.
Yes.
Okay.
I bet you it was very safe, right?
Yes.
But I bet you the process of making that safe, right? Just think about this. Let's just forget about like the inner workings of the film business. You want to blow up a building.
Yeah.
At a specific time and date, right? What are the things that you need to make sure of before you blow that building up?
It's going to have explosives in it.
Yeah, it was like, are there going to be people in it?
Is it a
number
real,
one?
Is people, it a real building?
Are there people that can
we have to build the building?
Get to it.
Right?
Are there people that can get to the building? So meaning I put all the explosives in it and then I'm going to walk down the block and I'm going to push a button to explode the building. How do I know in the time that I walked from point A to point B, a kid didn't run into the building?
So it's interesting. What I know, some interest, that building was like an old factory that they were kind of masked as a hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Somebody had stolen all the windows out of the building. Like the second, so there's like portions of the building that are actually CGI.
Right.
Because somebody went and stole all the windows after, I don't know if it was after it was wired. That's,
a controlled demolition like that, I feel like takes probably days. I've never done anything that big of an explosion. Like I've done some big explosions, but they're mostly just like.
I haven't worked on anything blown up that big.
I've worked on big, I've had some movies that had really, like blowing up an airplane, right?
Yeah.
But that's like, you put a bunch of explosives in the thing and it blows. This is like, all right, the building has to fall and it has to fall in its own footprint very safely because there is one in part of that safety of that thing, right? A consideration that you have. Will the building fall the way you want to fall? If the building falls the way that you don't want it to fall, could it fall in such a way that it could fall into another building that's filled with employees who are just selling insurance?
Exactly.
You know, right. Like, so if you just think about, yeah, I want to blow up a building in the middle of a city in a controlled demolition sort of way is like the process of thought and detail that you should go through, right, to make sure that no one's going to be harmed in doing such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. It's a lot to think about.
So that's why I was just thinking about like what you don't know kind of watching that movie. I mean, there's also like cutting room floor footage of Heath Ledger in the bus driving away. Right. And he's and you know, I forget where I saw this, but it's interesting that he doesn't even look right there. There is a building legit exploding outside the bus window.
Mm.
Right. So there is a camera in the bus. And then that footage, none of that footage is used in the film. You just get in the bus and then you kind of see the building and then it goes to a long shot and the building blows. But there's a camera, like a medium shot of him sitting in the bus seat, just looking straight forward, very purposefully
as
the
attention.
Building explodes in the background. So
Sounds awesome.
Sounds cool.
This is a very high value, obviously not just part of that production, but a very important person.
Yeah.
In a bus right next to an explosion.
Yeah.
You know? Mm. And I just thought that was – so a part of the debate is that he kind of walks out and the building is supposed to be kind of blowing up.
But, no, he gets to like a pretty far distance and then he starts hitting the button to blow it up.
Yeah.
So people say something went wrong. This is the debate, right?
Yeah.
So something went wrong and then he kind of improvised this scene.
Because he hits the button and the building doesn't explode.
Right.
Right away. Like when you're watching the film, even now, he hits the button. The building doesn't collapse.
Well, at first he's kind of walking down the hallway and he has the trigger and he makes a sound with his mouth and there's an explosion behind him. And then it goes outside and there's like some more explosion. He does the button again. It stops.
It gets bigger.
Yeah. Then it gets bigger and he gets on the bus and he takes off.
Yeah.
What actually happened?
I don't know. I wasn't there.
No?
No.
No.
I thought, didn't we talk about...
I've heard rumors that like it was just like the button was on the trigger and the trigger didn't work and then they just kept on pressing it until it worked.
How do you think they were that he was that close though? Because I bet that was a fiasco.
I think that here's the thing is you have these.
I mean, they could do tests.
Okay,
there's a lot of tests involved in those sorts of things.
This is really kind of this is where things get weird a little bit.
All right, great.
You are going to you're Chris Nolan. And I can't say that this is specifically what he asked, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he probably, in some way, shape, or form, is asking and pushing both, like, the studio's legal and the special effects coordinator, which when you're a studio, you're going to hire and you're going to do this thing. You're going to blow up this building. You're not hiring some fresh special effects coordinator, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to do somebody who's going to, like, set the explosives properly. The building's going to burn exactly the way he says it's going to burn. It's going to fall exactly the way he says it's going to fall. Everything's going to happen perfectly. And if he says Heath Ledger can be 20 feet away, well, this is a studio technician that's done X amount. We can probably look who this guy is up. And I'm sure if you like rolled down the credits on his resume, it would probably be like movie with massive explosion after movie with massive explosion.
Star walking away from it purposefully.
Yeah, with the star walking away purposely at sunset while everything is on fire.
Yes.
Yeah. This is probably a guy that's done that a million times. You're kind of putting all of that in that dude's hands and trusting whatever he says.
All right.
Until there's somebody that goes, I think Heath Ledger is too close.
Right.
And then the guy like me goes, oh, Christ. Well, you know, guy that's been doing this for X amount of years, can you explain to me and explain to this person why the building is it's going to be safe to be at this distance and why it's going to be the camera is going to be safe and blah, blah. And yeah, they have to offer a satisfactory explanation.
Yeah, indeed.
And they usually will, right? Like there's usually,
and you have to facilitate
like,
that.
There's not too many like run and gun explosion guys out there. Because they're primarily, they'd be the person. Like if Heath Ledger dies there.
Yeah.
Because the building explodes and falls on his back, crushes him to death. It falls squarely. The studio and everybody else is going to be like, well, this guy said it was cool.
There are like no real modern day Fritz Langs running around. I don't know if you know the story about Fritz Lang making movies like Metropolis or these mega scale German expressionists.
There's still some gangsters out there making films like gangsters. That's for sure.
I bet. But I mean, I'm trying to think. I know like the Bollywood. What's the... The film, there's a scene where they're all on top of the train and they do that great song, Jaya. Mm.
Like, I don't know that.
Hmm? Oh, man. We'll have to watch that
we'll
at some point.
Watch that
but
one,
a bunch of people died, fell off the roof of the train, in that movie. It was and it wasn't even all
How
at once.
How many people died during the filming of Fritz Curlardo, you think?
Oh, is that where, Werner Herzog drags the boat over the mountain?
Push a steamboat over a mountain. Hey, you know how we can do that?
Natives.
Yeah. Jersey Burden of Dreams?
No.
That's the documentary. It's about that movie. I think that's what it's called.
Is it Burden of Dreams?
Maybe not.
So I worked in a video store when I was in college, and I remember I was just walking around.
The greatest kinda, film school that ever existed.
Indeed. All VHS back then.
Seriously.
And I remember coming across the cover of this, like, maybe late 70s, early 80s movie, Fitzcarraldo, it's called. By the German filmmaker Werner Herzog, who did like Nosferatu remake and did the documentary about the guy.
Grizzly Man.
The Wrath of God.
Wrath of God. About the Spanish conquistadors.
Correct.
Yeah.
Strozek.
Isn't that your favorite film?
One of them.
Okay.
One of them.
Aguirre, Wrath of God?
Yeah.
Wow.
For sure.
I'll have to. I don't even know if I've ever seen it. I've seen parts of it, and that's Klaus Kinski.
Klaus Kinski. Correct.
Yeah. Who's in that?
Herzog also made a documentary about Klaus Kinski, like his friendship with him. It's called My Best Fiend. How they met each other. Herzog has this story, and he tells it in the movie about how Klaus used to get so upset, and he was so like out of control. I think they were roommates, so they lived in the same place, that he would go into like a bathroom for like a day and just break everything. He'd just go raging to the point where the porcelain like top of the toilet could just be like sifted through a tennis racket. Great movie.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I remember being in this video store and just staring at the cover of this movie where there is a boat.
Steamboat.
Being pulled over, and I was just like, what the fuck?
I'm pretty sure it's called Burden of Dreams. I think it's a documentary.
I think I took it home and started watching the movie.
I think the same guy made a documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now, I think.
Yes.
Heart of Darkness?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think
that's the same director as a documentary about the making of a movie. But yeah, like he pulled that whole boat like over a hill with the natives. Like, how? It's incredible.
Literal blood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how. Yeah. And people died. Pushing that thing over that thing. And I was like, all right, well, we're making a film here, guys. When's lunch again?
What an image, though.
Like, sorry, everyone. Image. This is important.
Sorry, guys. This is really important.
This is really a vision.
Look, that's that thing, right? Like, that's that thing. It's like people dying on movie sets is not a thing hasn't happened before.
Of course.
And, you know, there's always this line that's pushed. This is where it gets weird because the factory floor gets pushed out of the confines of the factory floor and into the streets and into the woods and onto rivers. And that's where it gets weird, right? Like, you didn't hear about the kind of stuff like that.
Where there's like, you're off the assembly line.
In like the studio era of like making like Wizard of Oz and stuff where like, you know, you're in a stage for a year and a half shooting that movie every day,
but you still have problems.
You still have problems
because,
for sure.
Like, there's the famous scene they're going down the Yellow Brick Road. They're off to see the wizard. There's a song that goes along with that, and in the background you see something. And the conspiracy theory is that it's somebody committing suicide. It was one of the goddamn monkeys running up a tree.
Right.
The flying monkeys, like, and the animal trainer or manager or person trying to catch this monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can, and they just needed to use that shot, so it's in. You can see this.
I've never heard that one.
I've heard that response, but
we know the shot.
I
right?
do.
Yeah. Okay. And that's like in one of the most controlled environments you can imagine.
Sure, that's something going wrong, right? But we're talking about like fatalities.
Oh, sure. Yeah, exactly.
Like an S, you know, or. There's somebody that died, 2 years ago on a film set for being in a position that was just completely like an unsafe and bad position. But that's like, you know, always trying to push the envelope of what you're trying to do in some sense. Any of these like big scale stunts where like, you know, I worked on a film where Tom Cruise hooked himself to the roof or the hood of a moving car down a highway, right?
Uh-huh.
It's like, well, it's not really a stunt unless you can see my face. Like, the audience doesn't feel worried for the main character's, like, health and safety. If it's not, like, my face, then they know it's a stunt guy.
You guys have seen the footage of him breaking his foot doing the stunt in the new Mission Impossible movie?
No.
He jumps from one fucking building to another one.
Yeah.
He's got to be 55.
He does it, right? He does it so that you can see it's him because there is a potential that he could be hurt.
Well, right. But you have coverage of it from every angle. Mm-hmm. So there is a shot of him. Now, he's, you know, there's two suspension wires, obviously, because he's jumping between, he is making a jump between two buildings that are more than five stories tall.
Yes. He's got a line.
Exactly.
Yes.
There's a camera like situated right on the ledge of the other building. So as he lands, it's his. Hi, I'm Tom Cruise.
Hi, here I am.
Here I am. Now you can see the look on his face when he breaks his foot, right? His foot snaps back where his toes almost touch his shin, right? This crazy guy gets up and starts running with a broken foot just to finish the shot. Which is amazing.
Just like a G.
Which is, yes.
People say, you know, people love talking shit about Tom Cruise.
Not me. I love him. You do better, I say to those people who like to talk shit.
Exactly. Let's see you hang off the side of a plane or a giant building for, you know, America's entertainment.
You confront Iceman.
Yeah, you confront Iceman.
In the locker room.
See how that goes. All that charisma and all that cockiness and that strut he has. Oh, yeah, you talk a big game.
You and Goose win at volleyball.
Exactly.
Tom Cruise, of course, did other things.
He did other films. Yeah.
On that note, let's take a break.
Part two.
Let's regroup and we'll come back for part two.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I thought part two was like some other time.
No, it's soon.
Drive.